If we are not careful, we could very easily misunderstand the spirit of the question that the scribe came to ask Jesus and the answer that Jesus gave. We might be tempted to think, if we come at this passage with our modern presuppositions, that when the scribe asked Jesus about the greatest commandment in the law, he was trying to minimize the law. We might imagine that he felt burdened by it, that he thought that the law contained all too many commandments, too many prohibitions, too many thou shalt nots, that the minute regulation of the worship of God, that the insistence on justice for the widow and the orphan, that the requirement that we be self-controlled and pure, that the law of God, with all its demands, in short, was far too heavy. We might imagine him asking, "Teacher, what is the greatest commandment in the law? Let me just focus on that. Let me forget all the others. That one commandment ought to be enough for God." But to understand the true spirit of that question, to understand Jesus' answer, we have to walk back in time through 13th centuries to the time when the people of Israel first received the law of God. We must not imagine that the people were merrily going about their way when God interrupted their lives with a set of demands. The story, as it's told in the book of Exodus, is far different than that. When we encounter the people of Israel at the beginning of that story, they are chained in a bitter slavery. They are in Egypt, far away from the land that was promised to their fathers. They feel the heavy thumb of Pharaoh's oppression weighing them down. And in that situation, without earthly hope or earthly encouragement, we read that God came to their rescue. He spoke to his servant Moses. He revealed to him his name. He told Moses what he was planning to do, how he was going to set his people free. And then, in marvelous fashion, he did. We read in the book of Exodus how, with arm outstretched and power in his hand, he fought against Pharaoh. He humbled Egypt's pride. He broke the chains of slavery that bound his people and led them out against all hope from the land of bondage and despair to a mountain in the desert where he gave them the law. In forms of majesty, in smoke and thunder, with a voice like a trumpet, he gave them, written on stone tablets, the law. The law was treasured by the people of ancient Israel as a most precious gift that they had received from God. For this law, given at the moment of their liberation, at the moment of their rescue from slavery, was meant to show them how to live in a relationship with the God who loved them, with the God who set them free, was meant to teach them how to live as citizens of his kingdom, was meant to show them the path to heaven. It is against that backdrop, the backdrop of the Psalms which sang how the law was sweeter than honey, the exultation which cried out, "My delight was in the law of the Lord." It is against that backdrop that we have to understand the scribe's question and Jesus' answer. "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" This is no attempt to minimize the law, to whittle it down, to dispense with the other commandments. This is an attempt to get at the heart of the law, to get at its soul, to find its center. If the law is the instruction, the teaching of the Lord, this question wants to know, what is the law, with all of its commandments, teaching us to do? And against that backdrop, we can understand also the Lord's answer. Love. The center of the law its heart and its soul and its purpose is love. A love which is not confined and minimized, but a love which is expansive and total. A love not of the paltry things of this world, but of the Lord our God. A love that is not confined to the heart, but extends to the mind, to the soul, to the strength. A love that extends to all God's children, to the love of our neighbor as ourselves. This is the center and the heart of the law. This morning, I'd like to take a moment to consider just one aspect of that greatest commandment as Jesus explained it to the scribe who asked him. He said that we should love God with everything, with all that we have and all that we are, with heart and soul and mind and strength. And this morning, I'd like to take just a moment to consider one of those four aspects, to consider what it means to love God with all your mind. At the outset, we might think that that's a strange commandment. We're taught by our culture in some ways to regard love and the mind as things that are as often as not opposed to one another. We pit the head against the heart. We imagine that these are two opposite aspects of the human being locked in a struggle with each other. And when Jesus speaks, when the commandment speaks of loving God with all our mind, we might be puzzled. But if we pause to consider for a minute the nature of love, the puzzlement will begin to fade away. Consider romantic love for a moment, the relationship between lovers. Love always seeks union, and lovers want to be united with each other. Far more than any physical union, what they want is to know each other and to be known. Without that, all the physical intimacy in the world, all the emotional excitement, will seem like a paltry pleasure that fails to satisfy. Where the lovers have not been bound together by mutual love, where they have not been able to share with each other their mind and their heart, the goal of their love remains unfulfilled. So it is in romantic love, so it is in the love of a family, so it is in true friendship, so it is even and especially when it comes to the love of God. We love God, we want to be united with him, but God is pure and infinite spirit. He completely transcends and completely escapes the reach of our senses. We cannot see him, we cannot smell him, we cannot touch him, and yet we can be united with him, for we can know him. For this reason, he has revealed himself to us, that we might learn to know him, that we might learn to love him with all our mind. We hope for that day in the glory of heaven, when at last our mind will be completely filled with him, when no more in shadows and in obscurity, no more as in a mirror darkly, but clearly and face to face, we shall look upon God as he is in himself, look upon his beauty and his goodness and his mercy and his wisdom, see him as he is, know him as he is in himself. And love makes us long for that day. But until that day come, the principal connection between our mind and God is the bond of faith. And if we are to love the Lord our God with all our mind, we must ever be striving to make that faith grow. We mustn't just believe it and think of it occasionally, perhaps when we say the creed at Mass on Sunday. We must let that precious faith penetrate every fiber of our being. We must meditate on it. We must study it. We must let it change our entire worldview, our view of God, of ourselves, of our brothers and sisters, of the world, of the course of history, of the course of our own lives. And one of the principal places that we can do that is in prayer. In prayer, we raise the mind to God. In prayer, we exercise the life of faith. In prayer, in meditation, in considering God's precious word, we give our faith the opportunity to grow. If you have a habit of prayer, I would encourage you to renew your commitment to that habit. If you don't have a habit of prayer, I would ask you to consider to begin to make it a habit, perhaps even for just a little while at the beginning, for 5 minutes, for 10, to carve out a space in your life, a space away from all the noise and all the distraction, a space in the silence, to raise your mind to God, to hear him speak, to consider his word, to let the light of that word fill your mind, to let it transform your whole field of vision. This is what it means to love the Lord our God with all our mind. And what we say about the mind, we should say according to the great commandment about every other part of us as well. Not just our mind, but our whole soul is meant to love the Lord our God. We should love him with our imagination, with our creativity, with our memory. We should love God with our emotions, ask him to train them and to mold them so that everything inside us moves toward him, lit on fire with the divine love. Not just with everything inside us, says the great commandment, but with everything outside of us as well. We are to love the Lord our God with all our strength, with our physical actions, with our words, with our deeds, with the way we live our lives, till all that we have and all that we are is caught up in the fire of the divine love, till the great commandment be fulfilled with every fiber of our being, heart and soul, mind and strength. This is the first and the greatest commandment. And on those days when the fulfillment of that commandment is difficult, on those days when the labor of love is to sacrifice and to suffer, on those days when the sweetness of love seems like a distant memory and the pathway of love is the road of the cross, on those days, we must not look within ourselves for strength. On those days, we must raise our heart and our soul and our mind to the one who gave us the great commandment, to the one who showed us on the cross the way in which that commandment is to be fulfilled, to the one who won for us with his precious blood the grace and the strength that makes us able to keep it. For the truth is, we will never succeed in fulfilling so great a commandment if we try to fulfill it with our own strength. We must learn to say, as St. Paul said, I've been crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live. Yet not I, but Christ lives in me. And the life that I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me.